wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning we moles burrow down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. I'm your host today, Laurie Mercier, and Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This week on The Old Mole, we commemorate May Day, the International Workers' Day celebrated around the world, which had its origins in the United States in the late 19th century with the 8-hour day movement and the martyrdom of five anarchists following police violence towards strikers in Chicago. In two interviews this morning with Lane Wyndham and then Aaron Brenner, we explore the history of working people and how understanding collective power, whether in defeat or victory, provides lessons for present and future struggles. And we end the hour considering the possibilities of broader intersectionalities and coalitions as Desiree Helgers and her interviewees remember the life and work of Danny Somerville, also known as Danny Summers, a 20-year-old musician, songwriter, and activist with Occupy ICE PDX, who died in February. There's a Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference this weekend in the University Place Hotel and Conference Center near PSU, which will commemorate the 1919 Seattle General Strike and many other examples of a militant regional past. This conference is open to the public, and a keynote presenter is Lane Wyndham, who is with me on the phone. She spent 20 years in the labor movement and is now Associate Director of Georgetown University's Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. And she has an important new book, Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of a New Economic Divide. Welcome to KBOO, Lane Wyndham.
Hi, Lori. I'm really happy to be here with you.
Well, thanks so much for coming on today. The power of unions in workers' lives and in the American political system has declined dramatically since the 1970s. And many have argued that the crisis took root when unions stopped reaching out to workers and workers turned away from unions in this period. But your book tells a different story about many forgotten struggles of the 1970s when millions of workers of color, women, and baby boomers tried to organize workplaces in private and public sectors, including the South, which had had so much difficulty organizing over the decades. Tell us about this forgotten history of 1970s militancy.
Sure, Lori, I'd be happy to. And I'll just say I'm so excited to come to Portland. It's my first visit, and I am excited to be part of the conference.
Great.
Yeah. So, you know, you're exactly right that a lot of times when journalists and historians talk about how working people lost power in this country, how unions have gotten weaker, they point to the pivotal 1970s. And some historians have even said that this decade was, quote, the last days of the working class. And my story is really different. In Knocking on Labor's Door, I talk about this decade as one of really great working class activism and promise when especially women and people of color were leading a whole new wave of union organizing efforts. So really, in Knocking on Labor's Door, the 1970s are the first days of a newly diversified, reshaped, and re-energized working class. I think that many historians and really pundits in general have been blind to the 1970s working class vitality because they've focused on one thin slice of the working class, which was unionized white men. And so they often tell a story of backlash and defeat. But I ask readers to broaden their focus to the women, to the people of color who did not yet have unions but were trying to form them. They had finally gained new access to the nation's best jobs and to the nation's unions following the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And as they poured into workplaces in the 1970s, they demanded unions because they didn't just want a job, they wanted a good job. And so they tried to organize.
And they're using these new legal tools provided by the Civil Rights Act of 1964, as well as some of the older traditional methods of labor organizing.
Well, that's right. They are using the National Labor Relations Act, so they're voting in labor board elections, but they are also gaining momentum from the Civil Rights Act. They are coming into the workforce in a new way, and in some cases, they're also using the new tools that they won under civil rights law in order to make sure that they have more power on the job. So a good example is the organization 9to5, which was based out of Boston. This is a group of women office clericals who formed first an association. They didn't form a union at first. They formed an association in order to gain more power, and they filed many suits through civil rights law. And then they also formed a union, SEIU, what was first local 9to5. It later became district 9to5, and began to organize both in the public and private sector using that organization. So there's lots of activity if we agree that we need to look at a broad swath of workers, not just a narrow slice.
So that SEIU local, of course, and many others like it are organizing new public sector workers who include many women and workers of color. And an important point in your book is that this declining union density that many people have pointed to beginning in the 70s does not erase the breadth of union organizing.
That's exactly right. You know, a lot of times what the experts count when they talk about the decline, they point to the decline in union density, which is the percentage of the workforce that has a union, or they point out that workers were beginning to lose more union elections than they won. And we can talk about why that was. But what I did in this book is I did something different. I didn't just look at the workers who won a union. I looked at all the workers who are trying to form unions, who are voting in National Labor Relations Board elections, whether they won or not. And what you can see by doing that is that 500,000 workers a year were trying to form unions throughout the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s. It doesn't drop until about 1982-83. So there's definitely a continued push in the 70s, and it's a far more diversified group that's trying to form a union in these years.
Well, we want to talk about some of those mechanisms that are enacted in the 1980s that begin to stymie worker activism and increase those defeats. But why is it important to look at defeats as well as victories?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that working people, a lot of times when we're talking about how workers lost power or how unions got so weak, there's an assumption that working people didn't try, that working people didn't fight. In fact, there was a massive class-based battle throughout the 1970s, and working people fought really hard and lost. And fighting and losing is a very different thing than not fighting at all. What we learn from studying their struggles is that they were fighting with what were increasingly weak tools, because workers had to face increased employer resistance to union organizing starting in the 1970s. While employers had never been thrilled about unions, they began to dramatically increase their resistance in the 70s. They began breaking the law far more often, bending and breaking the law. They began hiring far more union busters, who, by the way, used the fact that there were more women and people of color to stir up fear among employers to get them to hire them, to tell them how to keep these folks from trying to form unions. And so what you see is that while fewer people are trying to organize by the early 1980s, it is only after a decade or longer of this incredibly vicious attack against union organizing by employers that workers begin to pull back. It's not something that just happens in the 80s. They've been under sort of attack for a decade.
And what explains the rise of this employer resistance, and what kinds of tools do they have at their disposal? I mean, you just mentioned they're breaking the laws, breaking labor laws, but what else helps them quash worker organizing?
Right. In the 1970s, employers do three things to increase their resistance. They become far more willing to bend and break the law. Basically, the law is so weak that they realize they can bend it and break it, and there's no penalty, really. And the law breaking is effective. While workers won roughly 80% of their union elections in the 1940s, by the late 1970s, they were winning less than half. The second thing that happens is even unionized employers at the core of the economy, companies like GM, U.S. Steel, Goodrich, that had long been union, they began to viciously fight workers' efforts to unionize in other places that were not yet union. This is new, that you have these unionized employers fighting so hard. And the third thing, of course, that they do is to rely more heavily on union busters, who many of them received their training in the nation's universities that began to teach that good business practices involved resisting union organizing. And so you ask why employers decided to fight back in the 70s. I think we have to talk about what's happening in the economy, which is by the late 60s, early 70s, employers are facing a newly globalized, financialized economy, and they begin to realize that it's far easier to attack unions, to attack union organizing efforts, than to try to take on the whole global economy. And so they begin to squeeze labor costs, and they do it in lots of ways. They begin to move towards temp workers, they begin to move towards contract labor, all of which we're more familiar with today. This is when it begins. And as part of that, they make this vicious effort to attack unions and to close the door on union organizing.
This is Laurie Mercier. I'm speaking with Lane Wyndham, author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of a New Economic Divide. She will be here on Saturday at the Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference. And Lane, I really like the metaphor you use in the book, Knocking on Labor's Door. What does that metaphor say about this enthusiasm for union organizing and yet the resistance, or maybe if not resistance, the inability of the broader labor movement to really welcome and recognize this kind of energy?
Right. So what I talk about in the book is that you do have all these workers who had long not been part of the nation's labor movement who are knocking on the door, who want to come in. And I conclude in my research that the union movement's record on opening the door to them is mixed. In some cases, there is more organizing than experts had realized. Workers are organizing through the steel workers, through auto workers, the textile workers, through the UFCW, and those unions are out there organizing and helping bring many of these workers in. However, the workers still faced lots of racism, lots of sexism on the part of the unions. You know, for instance, there was one woman who was active in her graphic communications workers union. She was worked at a print shop, and she wanted to become a union organizer, and the person who led her local just laughed at her and said, "Women can't be organizers." Certainly, women and people of color being in staff positions, being in elected positions. And there are definitely times when the groups of workers who wanted to organize had to make their demands and sort of push their way in, too.
Well, I think most people know the story of labor's decline and certainly the rise of income inequality beginning in the 1980s. But how does recounting this story of the 1970s help us think about not only current debates about labor's future today, but really can inspire us to think about new ways of mobilizing and new ways of challenging employer power?
Well, I think that, you know, once we realize that working people fought back, they pushed really hard, they tried to form unions, they tried to, you know, make sure that they had power in an increasingly more precarious workplace, which is the shifts that are beginning to happen. Once we understand that working people were fighting, then we have to say, okay, the tools that they were using, which is the labor law, really, from the 1935 Wagner Act, that this is no longer basically a viable tool. They're not going to be able to win using that. So then we have to really think about how to build worker power in an economy that, like today, has far more precarious jobs. Lots of people are working on contract. Very few people will ever get the kinds of fair wages and full benefits that many union workers fought for. So in that case, do we have to start to think about the role of unions and the role of collective bargaining really is kind of bigger as that than that which was prescribed by the 1935 Wagner Act? Perhaps we have to think about collective bargaining as something that can bring lots of workers in, whether they have gone through this very narrow door into unions, right? Because it's such a narrow door. Employers have narrowed it down so much. Maybe we have to think about ways to lift wages, lift benefits, to lift social welfare outside the narrow confines of a union and one employer-based collective bargaining agreement.
Social security measures then provide people the opportunity to spend more time organizing and expand their power in the workplace.
That's right. That's right. Because as you know, working people today are holding down two or three jobs and nobody has time to do much of anything.
Right,
that's
right.
True.
Well, thank you so much, Lane Windham, for joining us on the Old Mole Variety Hour. And folks can hear Lane Windham speak this weekend on Saturday at the Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference. Look forward to seeing you, Lane.
Thanks, Lori.
Started with a protest in the Gilded Age. Chicago, Illinois was the stage. Workers had gathered across the country to demand a living wage. First in Chicago, then in Milwaukee, the state of U.S. democracy was shown to the world with volleys of bullets from the police authorities. Word spread about what happened there across the country from Haymarket Square. Word spread across the oceans to just about everywhere that there'd now be a day when simultaneously on every continent in every country all the workers would march together for the world that shall be.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. That was singer-songwriter David Rovics, who will be appearing this Saturday evening at the Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference at the University Inn in Portland. And before the music, we heard from Lane Windham, author of Knocking on Labor's Door, who will also be appearing at the Labor History Conference in Portland. Here to tell us more about inspiring stories and lessons to be learned from labor history, and to help guide us in reviving labor militancy and revolts from below, are Bill Resnick and Aaron Brenner. Aaron Brenner is a labor historian who is also an organizer for the United Food and Commercial Workers, and they discuss history from below and why it's so important and inspiring.
Aaron Brenner, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Good to be here.
Aaron Brenner works for the United Food and Commercial Workers, organizing and working on campaigns at various grocery chains, including New Susan's. He's on the board of Homeland Stores, an employee-owned 80-store unionized grocery chain in Oklahoma and Texas. He's also a labor historian. He teaches. He writes. His major written contribution is the book Rebel Rank and File, Labor Militancy and the Revolt from Below During the Long 1970s. So, Aaron, why did you come to study working class and labor history and then go to work for the unions, fighting for union power and doing organizing?
I'm a second-generation red diaper baby. I grew up on the left and always was around rank-and-file organizing on the part of the working class. I went to strikes when I was little. I walked picket lines. And so I always had an interest in labor, but it took me a little while to actually figure out where I might fit in. Eventually, though, after college, I decided I wanted to go back and study labor history, that it would be a good way to follow my interests and see, for me, what was the agent of change in history, what I thought was the most important and most powerful group of people that could change the world.
Yeah, history, as Marx pointed out, this history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggle. In a word, oppressor and oppressed, standing in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, non-open fight. You're now part of that as a player in that struggle. But it did. It shaped the world. We can't understand what's happened to America or our country or our lives without understanding the role of working people.
I think that's exactly right. My introduction to labor history came first in college and then in graduate school, where we learned that you really can't understand America's past or anybody's past without understanding the role that ordinary people, working people, played in that history. So whether you're talking about the American Revolution, the Civil War, the New Deal, the Progressive Era, whatever era you're talking about, labor and the role of working people of all stripes, all colors, gender, we're all involved in that. And you can't really understand why the Civil War happened. You can't understand how the Constitution took shape. You can't understand the New Deal if you don't understand the role that ordinary working people played and their organizations played in shaping those events.
Yeah, let's just do one example, maybe, or two. The Bill of Rights of our Constitution, one of the great glories of American life, that we promote ourselves as the beacon of democracy in the world. Well, there would have been no Bill of Rights if it weren't for the uprising during the Revolutionary War and after in creating the Constitution, without working people saying they would not vote for it without a Bill of Rights. Is that accurate?
Well, I think that what took place was, you're right, that as the Constitution was being drafted and as the revolution was taking place, the working people in various places began to question exactly what their rights would be under this new form, and they were concerned that they would not have the say in what took place in the federal government without these rights. So they pushed for them.
Aaron Brenner, in the modern world, working class people have, in fact, lost many of those struggles. It's important to understand why and what could be done. That seems to me another part of labor history and working class history, is seeing the failures and the losses that people have undergone, and in fact is thinking about different campaigns, better organizing. That seems to be part of your heritage, actually. A lot of losses, in fact.
Well, yes, the history of organized labor certainly is one of both defeat and victory. Organized labor has brought about a number of very important reforms in the United States, everything from the 8-hour day to paid vacation to the weekend. These are all the results of struggles on the parts of the labor movement. The labor movement has obviously risen and fallen over time for various reasons, but the lessons I think that we can draw are about the power of organization and the power of collective action. And it's where those workers are most well organized collectively that they've been able to exercise the most power.
This is KBOO Radio and Bill Resnick talking to Aaron Brenner, a UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers. He's an official and also an organizer, and he's a writer. He edited the book, Labor Rank and File. We've been discussing the working class and labor history and what we have to learn from it and how important it is in shaping America. Aaron, the labor movement at some points made choices that, in fact, were really problematic and damaging for the country and particularly poor people. I mean, you might challenge that as well. But one of them seems to be, let's say, the decision and the way the movement operated after World War II in dealing with potential radical changes in medical care that never occurred. At least that's how I read it. How did you read that period?
Well, I think the United Auto Workers, for example, made a set of choices around how it was going to struggle for various kinds of benefits. And I think at this point, given the relationship with the Democratic Party, the level of mobilization, it was a tall order to win what we would call Medicare for All today or some kind of universal health system. And I think the UAW made the choice instead to fight for what became a privatized welfare system, to win employer-based health, employer-based pensions. The CIO unions made that kind of choice. I think if you're talking about more self-inflicted wounds and the kinds of ways in which labor has shot itself in the foot, I think the failures virtually every point in history until very recently for what were predominantly white male unions to organize black workers, Chinese workers, Latinx workers, and women workers into the same unions as those white male workers was an enormous burden and a huge failure that weakened the labor movement consistently.
Aaron Brenner, let's switch gears a little bit and go back to the initial question of why study labor history and working class history. It seems to me also what it offers is a much better understanding of our fellow human beings, of quote, human nature, or how what really motivates people, than certainly economics, and in fact the other humanities that are often dominated by a very sort of individualistic view of human beings. It seems to me, though, when we study labor history and working class history, we can get a very different vision of how people struggle, of the really heroic movements. We have a whole different set of heroes, it seems to me. Not great entrepreneurs, but people like Joe Hill and Helen Keller and Victor Jara and Dorothy Day and millions of uncounted people who have struggled and, in fact, often won and built the country. How do you see that? It seems to me it's so important for us to understand the understandings of our fellow humans that comes out of a critical, radical labor history.
I think that's right. I think traditional labor history is focused on the elites in our society. They've focused on politicians, focused on corporations, business elites, as the movers and shakers, the people who have shaped history. And it's true, politicians have shaped history, without a doubt. But working class people, ordinary people, have also played a very important role in shaping what politicians and others can do. The struggles of working people have brought about all sorts of important changes. And if you think about the civil rights movement, for example, it was, yes, somebody like a Martin Luther King was incredibly important in shaping that. But it was also the work of ordinary black working people who refused to ride buses, who demonstrated, who marched. Those people shaped the civil rights movement and shaped the outcomes just as much as somebody like a Martin Luther King.
Yeah, in fact, shaped the country and forced the Kennedy brothers, who wanted to somehow sweep it under the rug and make a few reform changes. Suddenly, they had to support the black movement in the South because northern people were seeing the atrocities. And it seems to me that it was that all the very courageous people on the ground, you know, as one great pundit said, what was her name? Martin didn't make the movements. The movements made Martin.
Right. I think another thing about labor history that's so useful and so valuable is that there are moments in labor history where we start to see the possibilities for a new society, the possibilities for a different way of organizing our work, organizing our social lives, organizing our family and community lives. And those moments are very inspiring and very educational and make us realize that, as you were talking about before, about human nature, we are social beings, we are collective beings. And when we're at our sort of height of our creativity, it's often in a collective manner. And so there are a number of examples. In fact, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the Seattle General Strike. And that was one of the first general strikes in the United States. It was a period of, after World War One of 1919, a massive upsurge of working class militancy at work and in the streets. And in Seattle, the port workers were on strike, trying to get more wages. The federal government had taken over the ports, but had refused to raise wages despite the fact that prices had increased during the war. And so they went on strike. And after a little while, the rest of the unions in the city voted to join in solidarity. And the entire labor movement in the city of Seattle went on strike. And the city simply shut down. The mayor didn't know what to do, mobilized the National Guard, but there was no violence. The workers stayed home. And then very quickly, through the unions, organized a series of structures to run the society themselves. So, for example, the Teamsters continued to deliver food and milk to people's homes and to stores. The union set up, the culinary union set up kitchens to feed 30,000 people all alone. And they did this through their own self-organization. And they started to run the city without the mayor, without the officials. And this lasted for only 4 days, unfortunately, because the threat of the National Guard scared some of the union leaders. The governor and the federal government refused to bargain over the wages of the shipyard workers. So the workers eventually drifted back to work. But there was 4 days there that demonstrated that working people could run the society for themselves.
This is KABU Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, talking to Aaron Brenner. We've been discussing how important it is and how fulfilling it can be to read working class history and labor history, at least radical versions of it, because it gives you a different sense of what the world could be, and it also helps one understand what this country is all about, what its people are about, and what kind of struggles we're facing, and how to win them. Aaron, it seems to me we're in a period where there's an enormous insurgency. The last election was really a repudiation of both political parties. People are extremely angry and upset. But also in that insurgency is being reflected in some of the labor unions who have developed a very different sort of organizing program. And as weak as the labor movement is, they have really come to realize they have to have community support. They have to stand for the community. There's a number of unions that are really terrific examples of that who have won strikes recently. Tell us about that.
Well, I think the most obvious and inspiring example is that of the teachers. The teachers have been on a series of strikes amongst teachers, first in the so-called red states, West Virginia, Oklahoma. Those teachers went on strike to get better wages, better school funding, and they've actually, in West Virginia, went on strike a second time. They clearly made their demands not simply about better wages, but about better funding for schools. And those red state teacher strikes inspired, I think, a series of other strikes, so-called blue state strikes, the most powerful of which was the strike by United Teachers of Los Angeles, January of this year, where they made what we call bargaining for the common good a central part of that strike, with a plan to win a series of demands, not just around teacher wages, but much more about school funding and about school services. They, like the Chicago teachers in 2012, had the motto that our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. And so they built community support. They supported parent organizations, other community organizations, and in turn, those organizations supported them in making demands on the school district that, for example, there would be a nurse in every school, that there would be more counselors in every school, that they would hire more teachers, that they would fight for restorative justice instead of the kind of punitive student discipline that was so racially biased and enforced so much more against African American and Latinx students. These kinds of demands made the strike incredibly popular. When they went on strike, there were demonstrations every day of 60,000 people, and there were only, I believe, 30 or 40,000 teachers. So clearly lots of people came out in support. So this is an example, I think, right now of how the labor movement is beginning to revive itself and beginning to see that in order to win, it has to represent working people as a whole, not simply the sectoral interests of one group of workers. And where they're able to make that set of alliances and make clear what they're fighting for, they can win.
Aaron Brenner, thanks so much for talking to us.
Back in the Depression, farmers held the line. When the bank came for an auction, together they'd combine. They knew that when divided, they could never win. But they stood shoulder to shoulder, didn't let the bankers in. They stood shoulder to shoulder, that's how they kept their farms. If one of them was threatened, it was for all to be alarmed. They said this was their land, and they'd help each other stay. That's how they kept their farms, that's why the bankers went away. 'Cause the union makes us strong. The union makes us strong. Back in the Depression, there was not enough to eat. But the union of the unemployed was in the driver's seat. If the cops did an eviction, took the bed and put it out, the neighbors would carry it in, sing a song and shout, the union makes us strong.
That was David Rovics, The Union Makes Us Strong. David Rovics will be appearing this weekend at the Labor History Conference, Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference. And we heard from Bill Resnick and Aaron Brenner discussing the inspirational stories from the past about struggle and lessons from those struggles, as well as inspiring stories about current struggles, including teacher strikes and other worker activism in the United States today. Coming up now, Desiree Helligers interviews Portland activists Sam and Alana about the late Dan Somerville, also known as Danny Summers, a 20-year-old musician, songwriter, and activist with Occupy ICE PDX, who died in February.
So my guests today are Sam and Alana, and we're talking today about Danny Henry Somerville, who was a committed and well-loved member of the Occupy ICE encampment over this past summer and who passed away in February. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you got to know Danny?
This is Alana. I met Danny at Occupy ICE. You and I first saw Danny, who was like frantically looking for some juice, like over at the water station. I like try to help Danny find some Gatorade, and he was just zooming around with his mobility device and just like on a juice rampage. And
met him at a really long, really boring GA meeting, and we were both like
General Assembly.
General Assembly, and we were like the only two POC who were present, and they were like, "Why are no one present?" And we're like, "Yo, we're here," but we just like don't know anybody, and so. And then, like Alana said, I saw him zooming back and forth a lot, and mostly just playing guitar with a lot of our other friends and just making music. He was a musician. He's a trans QT POC.
Danny, even though Danny usually used he, him pronouns, Danny also used they, them. And I know that folks' pronouns and think that are important to Danny.
Yeah, he'd just very often be sitting on the porch. Every single dog, too, would be like, "Can I pet your dog?" And they would always let him.
Yeah, and Danny was disabled in, like, some different ways, and did a lot of, like, disability justice activism through, like, his art and his writing, talking to people. And he was always, like, into, like, supporting people and, like, mutual aid, and would always want to cheer people up.
Yeah, and I think people tend to, you know, when we're talking about Occupy ICE, often people, I think, don't realize that there were quite a few people with disabilities and other kind of serious health issues in the camp. And that had to have really, I would imagine, taken quite a lot out of Danny to be physically present on the site as frequently as he was.
Yeah, it was definitely pretty hardcore. Like, I was impressed when he was able to get some housing outside of the camp. Like, he was able to, like, get rides and be present there and have maybe a little easier way to rest. Yeah, it was really cool seeing how people worked with whatever they had going on and, like, were present and, like, contributing.
Yeah, and there really was a very strong focus, it seems, on creating access.
Right. Now, I remember being part of the engineering crew the majority of the time and spending a lot of time building those ramps and fixing the ramps pretty frequently. It's activism, and it wasn't just at Occupy ICE, but a lot of other rallies and actions that he insisted on attending. Whether they were accessible or not, he wanted to be present and he wanted to be part of it and he wanted his voice to be heard.
Yeah, and did he raise access issues a lot?
Yeah, absolutely. They were central to the Won't Be Erased rally that was held after the Trump administration sent out that memo that basically erased trans people from, I mean, just legally, just by definition. He headed that and emceed it and played some of his music for everybody. And I just remember during the organizing that was what he was very focused on, was making sure that all of the different voices were represented. I definitely learned a lot. I just learned a lot about ableism and how little I saw of people's disabilities being very able-bodied, not being depressed, or at least having the same kind of depression that Danny has. Patience around that and listening to people when they say that, no, I can't do something the same way that you can, like physically.
But it seems like there was a real concerted attempt to create forums at Occupy to talk about exactly these issues. And I mean, certainly there was, you know, ongoing ASL access. There was, like you said, a sort of network of ramps within this camp. And I mean, was it an issue that was talked a lot about at GAs?
I stopped going to the GAs after a little while, but I do remember at first it was a topic that would come up pretty often. And yeah, again, like I said, being part of the engineering crew, we would be the ones who would address the physical accessibility.
And it seems as though this also raises questions of the health issues and access issues of people who are being held in ICE detention, right? People,
yeah, definitely.
I mean, mm-hmm. as difficult as it had to have been for many people struggling with health issues in the camp, I know that many of those people were there precisely because they do fully understand that one issue we don't talk about with talk about ICE is the fact that there's a range of people in detention who have all kinds of health issues and different kinds of disabilities, and we never center that experience in the discussion.
Yeah, definitely, like, thinking of the relativity of what the folks are going through who are migrating and being accosted and things, like, and just how bad those conditions were and are, made it so that we all wanted to be there because we were like, well, this is hard, but, like, think of how much harder it is for others. We can't just have ICE and all these DHS agents right here.
Yeah, and I'm sure sleep deprivation, you know, protracted sleep deprivation over a long period of time had to have been, and the stress of being in the camp and constantly facing, you know, Patriot Prayer coming by and spraying crap, literally crap, at people, and all the other stresses of being there had to have weighed really heavily on
right.
people.
Or yeah. Easy Street.
Yeah, and DHS, you know, there were some really violent confrontations where DHS was tasing people and assaulting them.
Shooting them with pepper balls.
Shooting
at really
them.
Close range.
Yep, yeah. Yep. So,
Do you want to talk about a little bit about what drew you to the camp initially?
I mean, this has been happening since the 90s. Both my parents are immigrants. Neither of them spoke English when they came here. Neither of them had anything when they came here, and they busted their asses to give me what I've had. Humanized the way that they are right now, I found myself in my bed just crying and like hoping that something would start happening because otherwise I was going to go insane. And fortunately, you know, the social media deities were smiling on me and were like, hey, check out this thing. And yeah, I went for a few days and then was out of town. And when I came back, there was like a fortress there. Made out of pallet boards and couches. And I was like, all right, here I'm in, let's do this. And
you know, I'm kind of hearing also that in some sense, sort of being at the camp was actually helped you to feel less despair about the political situation, that it actually had that very immediate effect. And I think to be in a community of people who are all that concerned about other people's well-being and the humanity of people who are being targeted and held in detention, I mean, I think that's a piece of Occupy that doesn't get talked about often enough, that there's a sort of mental health care and being together in a moment where you feel like the politics are so ugly.
I mean, there's that. That also very quickly turns into shared trauma when it's like they start shooting at you and you can't really talk to other people about it because they don't understand what it's like. I think that's what bound a lot of us together after it all ended. And, I'm ready to go again. Like, I'm just do what I can, give money to whoever I can, go to attend whatever fundraisers I can until we decide enough is enough, because these are concentration camps. They're doing this to Indigenous people again. It's like, come on now.
The family separation. That are also part of the African American experience. And
yeah, and all of the like broader context of just like imperialism and capitalism and colonialism, like all these systems of oppression that are all like interrelated. And this is like a very particular context that is so ugly, and it's an important thing to like be working on. But then I think we're all working on like the broader aspects of it too.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about sort of the shared trauma of actually, witnessing and experiencing that level of police violence, that is probably a small taste of what's been experienced at the border when they're firing, tear gas and some rubber bullets. I think the links to the sleep deprivation that you're experiencing recently, there were disclosures that at some of the detention centers, they were waking the families up every 3 hours. A great way to break someone, right? I mean, that's very much like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo.
Yeah, and like, on the smaller scale, like ICE doing that to us, they put these really bright floodlights on the camp, singing music. Yeah, I mean,
that was not cool.
And I would imagine that, like, with people in different states, different health issues, different ages, struggling with different kinds of disabilities, that experience of being kept up by loud music and floodlights must have been experienced very differently across that spectrum of the community.
Danny was like, he was really autistic in a way that was just like really genuine and sweet. And he would play I picked up the ukulele because that was one of his instruments. He had a few songs that he would play repeatedly.
But he also wrote his own songs.
Yeah, he wrote a lot of music, and it's still on his Bandcamp, Danny Summers. Probably as well as the one that all of his friends know, is called Love Yourself, which we want to play. It's something that made him super happy. Like I said earlier, he loved dogs, all dogs. Even when we were driving, he'd tell people out the window, "I love your dog."
I remember having really fun sing-alongs and dancing with Danny in the kitchen. And Danny was such a good dancer. And he had some really great, like, ballroom Vogue moves. Right. Where I was just like, where did you even, how do you do that? And would just like tear it up.
Patrick Kimmins thing, he started dancing in the middle of the street behind the police line, and like everyone was just cheering him on. Like, yeah, that kid could chase away like alt-right media people with his dancing and song. It was beautiful.
And so Danny had recently moved from Detroit. He'd only been in Portland for a matter of months. He arrived right before Occupy. Is that right?
That was the first thing he really experienced in Portland, actually, which is kind of intense.
Yeah, probably, like, arrived in June.
Yeah, like I said, we would use this song to chase away Nazis. One of the things that I definitely learned from Occupy and from all the activism last summer is that music is sometimes, actually a lot of the times, more powerful than fists. I understand the need for self-defense. I have seen them turn tail and run because they just don't. What are they going to do when you're singing and dancing and having a good time? Like, they does not compute. They short circuit real fast. And this song in particular, I'd seen it happen. Yeah, I think it not only chases away the bad guys, but really empowers the good guys, good people, good everyone. All the mothers and fathers and zothers who look down on us and bless us. With the power of music, as Danny would say, and his prayers. Okay, so once again, this is Love Yourself by Danny Summers, put in Bandcamp.
I think that's the way it appears in Bandcamp, is Summers,
right,
rather than Summerville.
Summers.
Okay. Yeah, that was his band name, but also by Danny Henry Summerville.
Summerville.
Ooh.
for the brokenhearted. This is a song for the queer kid in the corner, listening to Elton John on the radio while the other kids say all of the mean things that they tell you in ninth grade. In ninth grade. In ninth grade. This is a song for all of you who need to use the restroom but don't know which one to enter, which one to go in, or if you'll ever, ever know. This is a song for all the people on Rainbow Road. This is a song for all of you in the back row. And I'd like to invite you to love yourself. And I would like to invite you to love yourself. And I would like to invite you to love yourself. And I would like to invite you to love yourself. Love yourself. On Tumblr, if you need a sign, this is one. This is a song for all of you who have so much to say, but we never let them. This is a song for all of you who use AC and ASL. This is a song for all of you who said you would walk again, but you never did. This is a song for all of you who can walk, but it hurts so much you'd rather roll. Here you go. And I'd like to invite you to love yourself. And I would like to invite you to love yourself. And I would like to invite you to love yourself. And I would like to invite you to love yourself. Love yourself. And I'd like to invite you to love yourself. And I would like to invite you to love yourself. And I would like to invite you to love yourself. And I would like to invite you to love yourself. Love yourself. Love yourself. Love yourself.
Thank you so much for that. We've been talking today about Danny Summers, who also went by Danny Somerville.
Danny Henry Somerville.
Only in Portland for a pretty short time, but it sounds like Danny's going to be greatly missed. Danny died in February, and I've been talking today with Sam and Alana. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting us.
This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks, Desiree, Sam, and Alana, for that remembrance of the late Danny Somerville, or Danny Summers, a musician and songwriter and activist with Occupy ICE, who died in February. A memorial service is being planned for May, but a date has not yet been finalized. When we post the show, we will include links to Danny performing. A transcript of the show will be available later this week. Thanks, too, to Bill Resnick, Aaron Brenner, and Lane Windham for appearing on the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning. As always, you can listen to the entire Old Mole Variety Hour podcast, which will be posted on KBOO in the next day or two.